The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. It's the Indie Week Journal, and it's read today by John Federson. And it's the current issue, November the 17th, 2021. Well, for our music today, I'm sure you've all heard the term champagne music. And, of course, that brings a well-known and loved musical entertainer to mind. I'm not going to mention his name on the air today, as he has nothing to do with our theme music. That's played, as usual, by the American Expeditionary Forces Dinner Ensemble. To hit the beaches with our first article from Indie Week. Well, I better get right into our fairly thick issue today. News from Durham by Tomasi McDonald called Reparative Justice. H.M. Mickey Michaud, North Carolina's longest-serving member of the General Assembly before he retired in 2019, grew up in Durham. Before he was elected to the State House in 1972, Michaud worked at his father's law and real estate office on the 800 block of Fayetteville Street. His father's business was one of many in the High Tea District that was upended by the urban renewal of the 50s and 60s that promised new wealth and prosperity, but instead drove the Durham Freeway through the heart of the community, displacing thousands of residents and business owners, Michaud told the Indy this week. We had to move, he recalls. We succeeded, but there were those that did not. Now, decades later, the federal government, whose urban renewal program, initiated by President Dwight Eisenhower, destroyed Haiti and other burgeoning black communities across the United States, is proposing to help rebuild a part of Durham's most historic black neighborhood. On Monday, President Joe Biden signed into law the $1.2 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, that promises to rebuild the nation's crumbling roads and bridges, strengthen its water infrastructure and internet, while creating well-paying jobs and a better economy. The new law is purportedly designed to make good on the decades-long broken promise to rebuild Haiti and similar black communities with the creation of what the Biden administration describes as, quote, a first-ever program to reconnect communities that were buried under a federally funded highway system under the guise of urban renewal. The White House stated in an infrastructure fact sheet, too often past transportation investments divided communities like the Claiborne Expressway in New Orleans or I-81 in Syracuse, or it left out the people most in need of affordable transportation options. But that bill has already fallen short of the president's initial ambition. Biden originally sought $20 billion to finance the project, noted Fred Broadwell, an organizer with the Durham Freeways to Boulevards Justice Project, a group that works with the company Congress for New Urbanism, which advocates for smart growth. In an email to the Indy in early November, by then the funding had decreased to $4 billion. This week when Biden signed the bill into law, the funding had dropped to $1 billion. With violent crime soaring nationally in neighborhoods most affected by urban renewal, for some observers, reconnecting the communities with new roads does not begin to address the inequities that were left in the wake of the urban destruction. Broadwell, a West End resident and urban planner, says his group was one of the instructive chorus of communities that helped persuade President Biden to include funding to address the damage caused by urban renewal in black communities. Broadwell also noted that $1 billion will likely be used for planning and design, while an additional $4 billion in the Build Back Better legislation currently pending in Congress will be used for construction. Broadwell describes a national movement slowly gaining steam to tear down urban freeways that have destroyed African-American communities. He says instead of Durham residents trying to determine how to best live with the freeway that's becoming more and more congested during commuter hours, Get rid of the thing and replace it with a boulevard lined with affordable housing and retail leading into the downtown district. He said, the freeway cuts off the high tea area from downtown. That's a critical problem. If you remove the freeway, that frees up a fair amount of land for affordable housing. You could build a significant amount of affordable housing along that corridor and end up with a better street. Haiti and similar communities across the country thrived against all odds during Jim Crow and created businesses, homes, and most especially, community. Michaud recalls a self-sufficient community that didn't have to go across the tracks for anything, unless it was to do business with Mechanics and Farmers Bank, Mutual Savings and Loan, or the NC Mutual Life Insurance Company. All black-owned enterprises on Paris Street eventually earned the moniker Black Wall Street as a tribute to the community's economic success. When, in Michaud's words, urban renewal reared its ugly head in Durham between 1955 and 60. He had just returned to Durham after attending graduate school at Rutgers and worked at his father's business full-time while attending law school part-time. They promised to come in and do away with the blight and build a general hospital, and that's what we fell for. Michaud, who first ran for office near the end of the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott at the behest of a young Martin Luther King Jr., who became a close friend. Though Durham's General Hospital was built as part of the federal government's ostensible renewal of the area, Michaud notes that it's not at all in the heart of the black community. The Durham Regional Hospital, which first opened its doors on October the 3rd, 1976, merging Watts Hospital north of downtown and Lincoln Hospital in Haiti, sits miles away from Fayetteville Street on North Roxboro Road. Michaud says Fayette Place, the public housing apartments that were eventually built, were initially an improvement from the blight removed by urban renewal. But today only a vacant lot remains after Fayette Place was demolished more than a decade ago. It's more blight there now than what was there in the first place, Michaud says. So basically, we got screwed. Michaud says Biden's program should benefit people who lost their businesses and homes as a result of urban renewal, and he thinks businesses and homeowners who remained in the community and are now paying higher taxes as a consequence of gentrification should benefit from the federal funding. He says of one of the city's oldest and most storied congregations, Highway 147, because of urban renewal, ran straight through White Rock Baptist Church. White Rock had to move. Is there something that could be done for White Rock? There are arguments for and against. My argument is for rebuilding the community. Marion Johnson, a consultant with Frontline Solutions, a black-owned firm that supports local nonprofits and foundations with a focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, said in an email to Indy that she thinks the most urgent use for the Build Back Better funding is housing. And she concluded, not just building more affordable housing, but also extending an eviction moratorium until this pandemic is actually over. That includes funding rental assistance to accompany the moratorium, because pausing evictions without pausing rent really just becomes a horrible game of delaying the inevitable. Angela Lee is executive director of the Haiti Heritage Center, the former home of the old St. Joseph AME Church, that was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976. According to a joint 2016 report by the city's Historic Preservation Commission and the City-County Planning Department, the old church was, quote, a center in the Haiti community and remains today as the last authentic physical reminder of early Haiti. Lee told Indy this week that the infrastructure funding, coupled with funding from other groups that want to invest in the district, makes this the right time for city officials to redevelop the Fayetteville Street corridor and offset the damage done by Highway 147. Lee noted that although Haiti sits in the shadow of downtown, it's not currently mapped in the downtown district. Lee says the St. Joseph's Foundation in 2018 received a grant as part of the U.S. Department of Transportation's Safe Routes to School, which would reconnect Haiti to downtown by creating a safe walking route from the Haiti district to Paris Street. Lee said, it's less than a mile away. It would encourage our residents, especially our seniors, to get out and walk more and enjoy the beautiful scenery that could be created. Lee says the infrastructure funding could be used to perhaps shut down the Fayetteville Street exit off the Durham Freeway and the adjoining bridge to develop an even more expansive walking route into downtown. It would be a beautiful thing, she adds. The bridge is dangerous, and so many people have to walk that way with no barriers on the sides. I think it's important for the health of the community to close off the exit and create a walking area. I'm not a planner, but I wonder what that would look like. This summer, during the city's Juneteenth celebrations, Henry McCoy, a professor of entrepreneurship at NC Central Business School, introduced Haiti Reborn, a $1 billion proposal to transform the vacant 20-acre Fayette Place into, quote, a global equity project anchored by the world's first equity research and development park to systematically close racial wealth gaps by creating global networks of equitable cities. McCoy envisions a sparkling, global-minded environment where people in the community live, have access to centrally located resources, visit the Haiti Museum, study at an innovation school and research lab, work at a biomanufacturing facility, shop at a grocery store, enjoy food halls and retail spaces, and have structured parking. This week, McCoy told Indy that the Haiti Reborn concept proposes reconnecting the two sides of the Durham Freeway, quote, to represent what needs to be mended from the past harm. McCoy says the federal funds set aside for reconnecting communities could be used in Haiti in at least two ways. First, the city could set up a reparative justice fund, he says, and collect the names of families who were displaced residentially or business-wise from the Highway 147 project and the urban renewal. And he says the reparative justice fund could compensate those individuals or their families directly or purchase them replacement homes or businesses from what was destroyed. Likely it would be for their descendants, but it would try to address a past harm. Then, McCoy says, the city could set up a fund to support the same for the next generation because African Americans were harmed by the highway. He explained the number of homes and businesses destroyed without adequate compensation could be replaced currently and ensured they are owned by African Americans. This could hopefully lay the foundation for a rebirth of the community based on direct reparative justice or indirect. Next, from Jasmine Gallup from Indie Week, news about the Leandro judgment about the education system in the state. A Superior Court judge ordered lawmakers to fully fund public schools under this plan this month. The Republicans in charge have other ideas. In 1994, the year Kathleen Leandro sued the state on behalf of her eighth-grade son, Rob, legislators gave $4.1 billion to public schools. It sounds like a lot, but in reality, it was almost $500 million less than funding over the previous year. Today, the situation is much worse. In the past five decades, the share of money given to public schools in annual state budgets has dropped by 13%. Despite criticism from teachers, parents, and even some students, legislators have continued walking down a path they started down years earlier, a path toward defunding public education. The Leandro case started out as an effort to improve education for students in poor school districts, but over the years the focus has shifted to the quality of education as a whole. It raises questions that school systems and parents across the country are grappling with, such as, do we have enough teachers? And is my child getting enough attention at school? Like many pillars of politics, these ideas all boil down to money. And since 90% of the state's public education money goes to staff salaries and benefits, teacher pay has come under the spotlight. For teachers, it's analogous to working for a company that lays off half its staff, then decides they weren't needed anyway. The 2008 recession hit a lot of companies hard, forcing them to cut costs. But even after the recession passed, many stuck with a limited staff. After all, the job was still mostly getting done. Why pay for two teachers when one can teach math and science? Unfortunately, teachers and support staff are being asked to do more while being paid less are quitting. In September, Wake County reported a shortage of 274 teachers, a relatively low vacancy rate, but one that reflected an uptick in retirements and resignations. The school district also reported vacancy rates of 15% and more for bus drivers, child nutrition workers, instructional assistants, maintenance and operations staff. The loss of teachers and support staff during the pandemic was a body blow to schools. Fewer teachers, more students, and less money for programs such as English as a Second Language all combined to put schools in a dire position. Now exhausted and frustrated with the lack of pay raises, bus drivers and cafeteria workers are striking in protest. On Tuesday, hundreds of cafeteria workers called in sick to protest low pay and poor working conditions. Their walkout followed a similar protest by bus drivers last month that resulted in lengthy carpool lines. Such was the situation when, last week, Superior Court Judge David Lee ordered the legislators to hand over $1.7 billion to public education. The money would fund the first 2 years of an eight-year, $5.6 billion plan to improve education for children in low-wealth districts, dubbed the Leandro Plan. Under that plan, teachers would get a 5% pay raise in 2021-22. Principals would get a pay raise, and schools could hire more teacher assistants, school nurses, social workers, and school counselors. The state's pre-K program would also be expanded, so 75% of eligible children are enrolled by 2028. And money would go towards programs in poor school districts for students with disabilities, disadvantaged students, and English learners. Lee's court order comes after years of inaction from the state legislature, which was directed to take measures to improve public education back in 2004. A decade of litigation in the Leandro case ended that year when the state Supreme Court again ruled that the state has a constitutional obligation to provide all children with a sound basic education. Since then, judges have given the state multiple opportunities to comply with the ruling by increasing education funding, either through individual pieces of legislation or via the annual budget. The Republican-controlled legislature, however, has failed to develop a plan of action or make a sustained, comprehensive effort at expanding programs proven to improve public education. Until Monday, Republican lawmakers and Governor Roy Cooper were at a stalemate when it came to the budget and how much money should be given to schools. Even after the State Board of Education, alongside the Leandro plaintiffs, agreed on the comprehensive eight-year plan earlier this year, legislators failed to fully fund it in their proposed budgets. Weeks of fruitless negotiations prompted Lee to give lawmakers an October deadline to fund the Leandro plan, which they ignored, and then earlier this week to order state officials to transfer $1.7 billion to the Department of Public Instruction, Department of Health and Human Services, and the UNC system. And Lee said last week, for 17 years, this court has granted every reasonable deference to the legislature to put together and implement a plan. No budget has been passed, despite the significant unspent funds they have. 5 days after Lee's orders, state leaders finally reached a compromise on the budget. And while it does give more money to public education than previous proposals, it still falls short of Leandro. For example, while it would increase teacher pay in low-wealth school districts, it calls only for an average raise of 2.5% for teachers instead of 5%. The budget is expected to land on Governor Cooper's desk by tomorrow, Friday. Republicans have been vocal in their opposition to the Leandro plan, calling Lee a rogue judge and expected to fight the ruling. On the other hand, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Catherine Truitt, also a Republican, has been mostly silent on the issue. She sent a letter earlier this month urging lawmakers to pass a state budget, citing the many crises on the horizon should they fail to do so, but didn't specify how much money should be allotted. For now, Lee's order is still standing, a ray of hope for many education advocates. After 27 years with the Leandro case drawing to a close, perhaps Kathleen Leandro's grandchildren will finally get the education they deserve. Next, North Carolina news by Lee Taus, Sixth PAC. Democratic North Carolina Congressman David Price first won election in 1986, the year the last of Durham's cotton mills closed. With the exception of a single narrow defeat in 1994, that notorious red wave that ousted 34 House Democrats and birthed the modern GOP, he's held on to the left-leaning 4th Congressional District ever since. The district's heart is the Bull City, but it also encompasses all of Orange, Granville, and Franklin counties, as well as parts of Wake, Chatham, and Vance. Price is, quote, the epitome of a statesman and public service, said the other local Democratic Congressman G.K. Butterfield, which certainly rings true. Price, 81, has a well-earned reputation as an effective, no-nonsense lawmaker. He's cerebral rather than attention-seeking and would rather get things done than stand on ceremonies. He's helped push through education and consumer protection and has secured funding for a slew of state projects, from the construction of Raleigh's Union Station to an EPA lab and headquarters for the North Carolina National Guard. Last month, Price announced he intends to retire at the end of his term, leaving his seat wide open for a Democratic successor in 2022. The district, which has been recalibrated as the 6th, is one of three precious safe havens for Democrats in the new, heavily gerrymandered congressional map. Republicans would be poised to secure up to 11 seats, giving them nearly 80% representation in a state where there are more Democrats registered to vote than Republicans. Lawsuits are already challenging the legality of the Republican-drawn maps, and courts will ultimately decide if they stand for the March primary. The candidate filing period for the primary doesn't open for 2 weeks, but campaigns for that seat are already in full swing. State Senator Wiley Nickel, who currently represents Wake County, threw his name into the ring the same day Price announced his retirement and has already amassed a $250,000 war chest. Last week, Durham County Board of Commissioners member Nida Alam, the first Muslim woman ever elected to public office in North Carolina, launched her campaign and instantly raised $50,000, a figure she's already doubled. And outside Durham's North Carolina Central University Monday, Air Force veteran and small business owner Nathan Click announced he, too, would be vying for the coveted congressional seat. Several other big-name candidates are rumored to be entering the race, including State Senators Valerie Fouché and Mike Woodard, and former State Senator Floyd McKissick Jr., but the full candidate roster won't come into focus until the state's filing deadline, December 17th. Price's district has long been a Democratic stronghold. Price won with 67% of the vote in 2020. But the new 6th district condenses it into an even more tightly packed blue district by eliminating the rural areas north of Wake County. It's now expected to swing 74% Democrat, according to a recent analysis by the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, making it tied for the 9th district, which covers Charlotte, for having the highest concentration of Democratic voters. Political consultant Gary Pierce, a former advisor to Governor Jim Hunt, they made it a safer Democratic seat so they could make other seats more Republican. Democrats are looking at a bad year next year, and what they need to be looking at is how they're going to dig out of that hole down the road. The question isn't if a Democrat will win the 6th seat, but which, and in turn what brand of progressive politics resonates most strongly with 2021 voters. If Price represents the best of North Carolina Democrats of yore, what type of candidate will represent the party's future? Will it be a young, firebrand progressive like Alam, or a tried-and-true establishment candidate with deep political ties and a lengthy history of service like Fouché? With Butterfield's district now competitive, could the 6th be North Carolina's best chance to send a progressive candidate to Washington? You won't have to wait a year for the answer. The district is so packed that a Republican wouldn't stand a chance against a primate. November's election will be decided in the primary. Just because the 6th is safely blue, that doesn't mean a lot isn't riding on it. Midterm elections typically spell mayhem for the party in power. See the 1994 Republican Revolution following the election of President Bill Clinton and the Tea Party sweep of the 2010 midterms after Barack Obama's election. If Virginia's recent gubernatorial election, where Republican Glenn Youngkin defeated former Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe, is any precursor, 2022 is poised to be disastrous for Democrats in Congress. A red wave next year could see Republicans easily take control of the House, which Democrats hold by a mere 8 seats, and the currently deadlocked U.S. Senate. With Republicans controlling the legislature and Supreme Court, President Joe Biden would be effectively muzzled and at the mercy of a runaway GOP train. The most pessimistic prognosticators believe the subsequent descent into fascism will be swift and unrelenting. This makes the 6th Congressional District all the more critical. Blair Beeves, co-founder of the Carolina Forward, a progressive nonprofit, saying, "How are Democrats going to guard against fascism? That's the essential challenge Democrats are going to be grappling with for years to come. Someone who casts a vote and stays out of the fray, that's not really going to cut it anymore. The great debate among Democrats is, do we want to appeal to the center or do we want simply to fire up the base? And it's always hard for me to understand why people even have that debate, because to win at politics, you've got to do both. It may be easier to win running as a fire-breathing progressive, but what we need in this country and what this district ought to be in the lead in sending to Washington is someone who has progressive views but is able to get some things done in Congress. The challenge in this election will be standing out in a crowded field with viable races for Democrats and so many great progressive candidates packed into one district," says Maggie Barlow, one of the most sought-after Democratic campaign strategists in the state. Barlow thinks candidates of color and women will have a competitive edge, but they'll need to appeal to urban progressives and highly educated voters. She says, "Female candidates represent our best opportunity in a lot of these electoral environments. It's going to be someone who can really put together a strong operation very quickly and raise a lot of money by having a lot of institutional support." Pierce is quick to point out that black women are the most reliable Democratic voters. In terms of demographics, he agrees that women of color would have the best chance at winning the seat. Of the major candidates running or rumored to run, all but Nickel and Woodard are black or people of color. And Pierce says if 2020 proved anything, it's that North Carolina's old model for electability is broken. Cal Cunningham, your typical white middle-aged lawyer, was the perceived safe bet in the 2020 Senate primary. His campaign tanked amid a sex scandal weeks before the election, all but handing Republican Tom Tillis back his seat. The lesson of all that, Pierce says, is that there's hunger for younger new blood. Alam, 27, certainly fills that bill. If elected, Alam would be the second youngest person in Congress, behind Madison Cawthorn. In some ways, he's Cawthorn's inverse. Cawthorn fabricated his origin story, lying about the car accident that paralyzed him, falsely claiming he was accepted into the Naval Academy, while rallying supporters of President Trump with fear-mongering over socialism and liberal indoctrination. Alam also has a unique origin story, but hers is real. She was driven toward local politics after three of her best friends were gunned down in a racist attack in Chapel Hill in 2015. She sees herself as the progressive Democrat poised to not only inspire young voters, but take swift and meaningful action on the issue that matters most, climate change, saying, "This is our chance for North Carolina to elect a progressive fighter and not just a status quo Democrat. I'm the candidate in this race that understands the urgency of this moment, our moment, because our generation and the next is going to have to live with the repercussions." Nickel, 45, has a lengthy resume that includes working under Vice President Al Gore in the 90s and in the Obama administration. He says his experience is what separates him from the pack. "I've worked for two White Houses, held two terms in the state Senate, and having that national experience, I've flown on the planes, helicopters, I've been in the motorcades. I know what we need to do to make change," Nickel says. While Nickel may have the financial backing needed to run an effective campaign, Reeves thinks he will face an uphill battle because most of his base is in Wake County. Nickel disagrees, noting about 40% of the voters in the 6th District are in Wake. Alam, on the other hand, has lots of name recognition in both Durham and Orange counties. A slew of political newcomers will surely join the race in the coming weeks, but most of the major candidates interested in the seats have deep party connections, including Alam, who served as vice president of the North Carolina Democratic Party. Nickel has ties to Washington, and the names Fouché and McKissick are legendaries in their own right. Legacies. Reeves says party politicians consolidate behind one of their own. Especially given the contours of this district, we don't think a lot of them really have their finger on the pulse of the district. He continued, this is a much more liberal area now, and it needs a representative who's going to reflect that. I think people are going to raise a lot of money, but it's really going to come down to who excites the liberal base more. Right now, I'm seeing two candidates who can kind of do that, and one who can do it better. The 6th may not be Price's district. It's smaller, more urban, and younger. But Durham will continue to be its crux. Mayor Steve Shewell believes Bull City voters are looking for candidates that embody the city's core values, with racial and economic justice being at the top of the civic agenda. Shewell said, I think that voters everywhere want somebody with a good, strong record of achievement who has bravely represented the values of this community and has achieved victories for this community over time. Durham, in particular, wants a good, strong progressive who is going to go and fight for our values. After 3 decades plus in Washington, Price said in a statement that despite his many accomplishments, retirement won't bring a complete sense of closure. Democracy, more fragile than ever, quote, remains a work in progress. Looming over it all is the frightful legacy of the last 4 years and urgent questions about the future of our constitutional democracy. So while it's time for me to retire, it's no time to flag in our efforts to secure a more perfect union and to protect and expand our democracy. Well, next, Sarah Edwards' column, New Church on the Block. It would be hard to find a more desirable real estate location in Durham than 408 West Gear Street. The building, built in 1948 and situated at the intersection of Gear and Rigsby Avenue, is the former home of Weeks Motor Company and Hutchins Auto Supply and contains a sleek, immaculately white showroom. Floor-to-ceiling windows gives the space the feeling of a fishbowl. Over the years, prominent local businesses have tried to lease the space, but longtime landlord Mark Hutchins demurred. For several years, the property, which in conjunction with the adjoining Hutchins garage space, has an assessed total fair market value of $1.5 million, according to county tax records, and it's mostly sat empty. In early October, signs appeared advertising a new business taking over the space, Pioneers Durham. Quote, a project of Pioneers Church, offering coffee, tea, baked items, events, co-working, faith, community. A QR code directs to a website introducing future parishioners to the lead pastor, Sheree Lopez Jackson, and her husband, Daniel Jackson, both graduates of Duke Divinity School. Pioneers Durham, the co-working space and market, will operate in the showroom during the week. On the weekend, the space will flip to become Pioneers Church, a church plant of nearby Trinity United Methodist Church. The church and business spaces have different tax statuses, and the business portion, according to church leaders, will not be tax exempt. The website reads, we are pioneering a vibrant and fresh approach to church, uniquely for the people of downtown Durham, where creativity, compassion, belonging, and purpose come together to bring hope to the heart of our city. The website outlines the organization's aims, including facilitating redemptive enterprise and social entrepreneurship, and providing a space of commerce for micro businesses and startups to flourish and a church space that is open every day of the week as a local community resource to come, rest, eat, dream, gather, and play. The church's website invokes a blend of references, Black Wall Street in one section, which the name Pioneers is intended to honor, a call for city renewal with hopes for seeing Durham's bright future manifested in our time in another. Another section of the website says, did you move to Durham because you wanted to be part of the weird, creative, and diverse leg of the Research Triangle? The Who is Pioneer For section of the website reads, are you in a creative, technical, or medical field and dreaming or playing in the startup wonderland that is Durham? Soon, skeptical comments on social media proliferated, my own among them, as residents questioned the message that Pioneer's name and millennial LD-adjacent language sends to a gentrifying Durham. The church's affiliation with the Association of Related Churches, that's an umbrella organization that helps fund and plant churches and that does not affirm LGBTQ members, furthered that unease. Numerous churches in Durham also do not doctrinally affirm LGBTQ rights, including the UMC denomination that's planting the church. Still, a conservative church in such a prominent location has caused waves. Local journalist Matt Lardy commented on the Pioneer's Instagram, I'm very concerned about you opening a church in a very diverse, queer community, given ARC's discriminatory stance on marriage. Will you openly welcome and bless all members of Durham's community? To this, Sheree Jackson sidestepped Lardy's question and instead invited him to chat over coffee. Though Lardy declined, several people did sign up for a virtual Sunday Coffee with a Pastor event posted on the website. Jackson, who got into a car accident later that week, was unable to attend. As social media chatter piled up, comments on the church's social media accounts were turned off. Several commenters, including Lardy, were blocked, and the Instagram account for the business arm of the church was deleted. Dialogue about the church briefly quieted. Then, in mid-November, Jackson released a series of Instagram slides clarifying Pioneer's position on LGBTQ rights. Although the church will, quote, prioritize love and welcome because we follow Jesus, she wrote, both UNC's and her own principles prevented her from marrying LGBTQ couples. She wrote, I personally hold an interpretation of Scripture that Christian marriage is a sacred covenant between one man and one woman, and believe that sexual intimacy has the potential to be at its healthiest in that context. The Sunday morning after the slides went up, a pair of women were seen pouring a thick perimeter of salt around the church storefront, a rite traditionally performed to cleanse a space of negative spiritual energy. The salt lingered for several days afterwards. In person, Jackson, who was 37 weeks pregnant when we met, is passionate and eloquent. It's easy to see why she was drawn to being a pastor. On a sunny October afternoon, she showed me around the space. The project is still in the early stages, and Jackson says she anticipates the church will begin operations in February or March of next year. Still, several months out, the space is already polished, with one side of the room flanked by a bar that will serve locally sourced coffee, tea, and baked goods made by businesses that have a real ethos around equity. At the back of the room, olive green bookshelves built by Jackson's father line the wall. Here, 100 display cubbyholes will be available as artist vendor retail spaces for $50 a month. More prominent booth spaces go for $200, plus a cut from sales, with priority going to people of color and women. Upstairs, an airy room overlooking the downstairs will be the co-working space. Jackson hopes to lease memberships on a modest sliding scale of $25 to $50 a month. For comparison, average WeWork memberships go for $199 a month. Another small room will potentially provide child care so that parents could drop their children off while they work. Jackson says, I get really cringy about church spaces that are open for like an hour on Sunday for service and then take up massive real estate and sit empty. I have a lot of curiosity about how that space could be stewarded in a better way. So I started to ask about this, and the question that we're trying to answer is the loneliness question. How can we create that third space, the friend's couch space? Jackson became interested in this question of loneliness while doing a demographic study of Durham at Duke Divinity. The loneliness describes, she says, many of the transplants who have moved to Durham and who are interested in technology and startup culture and who came to Durham because they want to be part of the New South. As a half-Latinx child in a military family, Jackson says she identifies with the transient identity and made it an outreach focus. She says, I'm not native to Durham, but I'm also not native to anywhere. A third space, she says, will be attractive to millennial and Gen Z transplants seeking connectivity, especially after pandemic isolation. Jackson, who's in her early 30s, considers herself an elder millennial. To help guide people, she plans to have placards on the table for people to signal whether they are plugged in and working or want to share a table and chat. Her view of the wave of young professionals is optimistic. She says the hopeful thing about all the transplants, many of them, not all the transplants, is that they are actually politically left of center, which often indicates that they have a social concern for how their money is spent. She explains that her projections anticipate that the income made from the business, the co-working rentals, coffee station, market rentals, and 10% sales from market items, will be enough to cover the operational costs of the building, and 80% of the church tithe from parishioners can be allotted for neighborhood partners. She says, we're paying attention to what's happening right here in Durham. I mean, TROSA is right here. There's another school system right here. We're really excited about the neighborhood we've landed in. Still, the initial brand launch in the neighborhood was bumpy. When resident Monica Byrne commented on an Instagram post and asked if Jackson had a relationship with North Star Church of the Arts, the community space founded by Nina Freelon and the late Phil Freelon a block down the road, Jackson said that she had read the website and suggested that North Star reach out and welcome pioneers to the neighborhood. On the other side of pioneers, meanwhile, is Coco Cinnamon. The coffee shop staff posted on Twitter in early October that they had asked pioneers several times to take down a photo of the Gear Street Coco Cinnamon storefront, which lived on the church's homepage with the script Pioneers Church overlaid on it. When asked for comment, Jackson said she had never got any of the messages from the coffee shop and would have happily taken it down had she known there was an issue. By the end of the day the tweet was posted, the image was off the website. Whenever you're dealing with churches, Jackson says, it just seems like it's this big corporation. But it's just me. Kristen Nordgren, co-owner of the Mothership, a co-working space and retail showroom for local goods that was formerly located directly across from Pioneers and shuttered in 2020 due to the pandemic, reached out to both Jackson and the Indy to express concern about the new space. She said, I'm opposed to homophobia wherever it lives, but I'm especially concerned about the presence of pioneers in this particular neighborhood because safe spaces are so rare and important to queer people. Nordgren, who ran the Mothership alongside Kate DeCanto and Megan Bowser, said over the phone, the neighborhood has traditionally been so welcoming because of the community-facing business aspect. I fear that people will unwittingly stumble into Pioneers, not knowing that it's not a place where they're celebrated or embraced. Added DeCanto, Durham is very much about queer people, and I love that. I think a lot of people really embrace that as an identity of the city. For any place not to be affirming of queer people, and then they say they're a space for everyone, they're not being honest. Nordgren herself came out at the age of 29 and credits the Mothership for giving her the courage to do so. Quote, my expression of love is the most dignified part of my life, and you can't understand my humanity, let alone respect it, if you feel like my love is undeserving or outside of your paradigm of godliness and health. It's a surprise that one year there's a place that's so affirming it can actually draw out this really tender part of me that was kept hidden and let me step into this really beautiful new life. And then a year later, and like 10 feet away, there's a place that's purposefully opposed to me living that life. Sherita Jackson's road to ministry as a female pastor has not been easy. In a Facebook post from June 2017, she detailed a lengthy list of sexist pushback she had received from people who did not believe women should have church leadership positions. This, she says, is why she pursued ordination within the UMC in the first place. Parenthetically, this says, although she has not been ordained yet, she is an LLP, or licensed local pastor. Daniel Jackson, meanwhile, is an LLP at Trinity UMC in Durham and not a pastor at Pioneers, although he has a bio on the church website. Jackson wrote in the post, "The United Methodist Church has many growing edges, and of course, these things happen within its context as well. The difference is the United Methodist Church very actively affirms the ordination of women and works to destigmatize the issue. To many, the UMC is progressive, and Pioneers, with its millennial aesthetic and emphasis on food, friends, and fellowship, is a far cry from its stuffy counterparts. In some ways, this perception is true. The evangelical church at large is in crisis. According to a survey conducted by Pew Research between 2018 and 19, 65% of American adults describe themselves as Christian when asked about their religion, a number that reflected a dramatic 12 percentage point drop in the last decade. Black storefront churches struggle to afford rent, churches with older congregations struggle to fill pews, and denominational schisms within the church don't help balance the scales. The United Methodist Church is in the middle of such a divide. In 2019, worldwide delegates from the UMC, once the second largest Protestant denomination with 13 million members worldwide, voted to uphold its ban on the ordination and marriage of LGBTQ people. The denomination, which is broad enough to count both Hillary Clinton and George W. Bush as members, is expected to split at the 2022 General Conference into two factions, a conservative faction and another that affirms LGBTQ congregations. The Association of Related Churches, the organization from which Pioneers received support, including a proposed loan of up to $50,000, also maintains that marriage is only between a man and a woman. It also does not support female pastors. The loan, on top of a $50,000 church planting grant from UNC and some donations from friends and family, is how Jackson says the church affords rent. The ARC is a resource and not an organization to which Pioneers is theologically accountable, Jackson says. But when initially asked about her own stance, she hedges. She says, "It's a really tender question that needs to be handled relationally. I want to protect freedom. That's priority. That's my priority. So why would I politically advocate for someone else's freedom to be limited when freedoms are so essential to what it means to be a part of this country? I'm saying all that to say I don't always think that there is a relationship between a theological conviction and a political conviction." Not all UMC churches in Durham are loyal to this thusly called distinction between theological and political convictions. Several have actively pushed back against the UMC ruling on gay marriage, including Elizabeth Street UMC, just five blocks away on North Elizabeth Street, which was the first outwardly queer-affirming UMC church in the state. Duke Memorial, meanwhile, a prominent steepled structure on West Chapel Hill Street, hosts an annual Queerly Beloved service and has been known to drape its exterior in rainbow banners. In January 2020, Duke Memorial lead pastor Heather Rodriguez took historic action when she stood alongside 11 other UMC pastors and married Durham residents Caleb Parker and Thomas Phillips, who became the first gay couple to be married in the history of the 112-year-old Duke Memorial. Complaints were later filed against Rodriguez to church leadership, though Rodriguez was able to reach a just resolution mediation. The more severe risk that UMC pastors and ordained elders run in officiating the weddings of same-sex couples, Rodriguez wrote in the Indy over email, is the loss of ordination orders. But Jackson is called, she says, to make space for multiple perspectives. The Pioneer's Instagram story also reiterated this, quote, I hope to teach and create conversation around sexual formation with humility, listening, and compassion toward the ways that this interpretation has caused deep harm, she wrote. Our leaders commit to listening, apologizing when necessary, and continually growing in love, kindness, and healthy relationships. We commit to surrounding ourselves with voices unlike our own so that we might be better spiritual friends to Durham. As our interview ended, Jackson, whom I had never met before, shared how earlier that day she had prayed about our interview and had had a vision of me, quote, running away from something in a wedding dress. And that maybe there had been a period where, quote, you were saying yes to something you didn't want to say yes to. Leaning forward intently, she asked, does this resonate with you? I said that I didn't think so. Though as time wore on, the comment lingered uneasily in my mind, its imagery and message both vague and specific enough that it could resonate with almost anyone. Outside, it was after 5, and the sun was filtering into hazy early evening light. People were beginning to trickle past the antique orange car, referenced on the deleted business Instagram account as being an Instagrammable spot, outside the storefront and out towards Rigsby Avenue. The car isn't new, but the view it looks out toward is. On this street alone, multiple new luxury condo developments are springing up, including a 20-story project with rooftop penthouses near Motor Co. A recent News and Observer tally outlined more than a dozen developments in the work that will account for more than 2,000 market-rate downtown units. It is true, certainly, that the city is changing and that an affluent young professional class, one which likely does long for connection, is at the fore. Whether that intended connection extends to everyone, the new and old Durham, those lower income and those well-off, the queer in the straight, is a harder task and an open question. Pioneers is certainly not alone in encountering these questions. United Methodist churches across the United States are answering them with varying degrees of welcome in real time. The difference, perhaps, is that most churches do not double as a business, do not attempt the language of both radical and conditional acceptance, and are not as visible, as keenly on display, as Pioneers is in its glass showroom. Jackson says, diversity can be really challenging. It can also be really beautiful. It can lead to a really rich life. To be walking with friends who have diversity of thought, and to be able to take a step away from a lot of echo chambers, to be able to see the humanity of one another. It is what I hope we live out here at Pioneers. Now, in 2 more days, on the 19th of November, 2 local music releases will be coming out, and both of these are reviewed. I'll be able to just excerpt both of these reviews, one written by Brian Howe writes one and Grant Golden writes the other. Josh Moore's release, Sunrise. Josh Moore doesn't pipe up all that often, but when he does, the sweetest sound comes out. The Carborough-based singer-songwriter and guitarist hasn't released an album since Parted Ways in 2015, and his gentle, laconic personality shows through in homespun tunes that refuse to make a fuss about themselves. But if Moore is something of a best-kept secret among local indie Americana fans, he's well-known among local musicians, as the pedigree of his quiet, intimate new record attests. Sunrise features supporting players such as bassist Casey Tall, guitarist Ryan Gustafson, and harmony singers Skylar Gudash and Libby Rodenbaugh. Alan loves and Whit Wright's pedal steel sprays starlight over superbly simple arrangements that either move at an easy, lonesome canter or ache in empty space. These general reassurances are contrasted with the relatively finer grains of experience on standouts like Hard Road Ahead. But even when our dulcet-voiced companion turns personal, less is Moore. That's Josh Moore. And the release is called Sunrise. And Grant Golden's capsule from Rhodes, R-O-D-E-S, M.K. Rodenbaugh's debut is Rhodes, All of My Friends. It's a revelatory record that magnificently captures the anxieties and pitfalls of early adulthood. Produced by Alex Bingham, the album is a pastiche of pastoral folk and evocative 90s indie rock that finds Rodenbaugh ruminating on love, loss, and insecurities. But despite the serious nature of that subject matter, Rodenbaugh's songs contain a hesitant sense of hope, making All of My Friends a remarkable ode to resilience. His songwriting skills are embellished by the musical stylings of standout triangle musicians, including Skylar Gudash, Ryan Johnson, and MK's sibling, Libby Rodenbaugh. Rodenbaugh's gripping self-awareness washes over the listener as they croon these words. It's a brilliant blend of grit and grace that closes the chapter on the struggles and triumphs of a young adult exploring uncertainty. And that release called All of My Friends. And both of these releases are given 4-star reviews by their respective writers. And finally, I have just about a minute to outline an op-ed at the beginning of the Indie Week by Nathan Spencer, A Lifeline, talking about addressing the bus driver shortages. Everyone's talking about growth, but once again the focus is on new jobs that pay $200,000 instead of the lower-paying ones people already have that make the creation of those new jobs possible. I'm talking about our public transit bus drivers. As it turns out, Go Raleigh hasn't been able to squeak through by having its drivers work significant overtime and having supervisors fill the voids. And while drivers have seen their pay increase by 5% overall to a starting pay of $16.25 an hour, the maintenance and cleaning staff who are equally and sometimes more exposed to COVID-19 haven't seen any of that bump. We need to address the bus driver shortage because it directly affects our ability to grow as a region. This begins by paying them more. In most of Wake County, $34,000 is not enough to live on to pay for child care, food, and other essentials. In the long run, municipalities that want to connect are going to need to raise taxes a little to pay for it. But we can start right now by prioritizing some of our sales tax funding for them. This might affect some of our Wake Transit Plan projects, but there will be no bus rapid transit crisscrossing Raleigh if we don't have anyone to drive the buses. Well, I have to close up shop pretty quickly just to say that this issue of Indie Week will be available on ncreadingservice.org's website. And just look for Listen and find The Independent. And you'll hear other recordings by me, John Fetterson. And speaking as John Fetterson, which luckily, that's who I am, I'm going to wish you all a nice week. And hopefully you'll be listening again next week for the Indie Week.